You are listening to South by Southwest Sessions.
Hello, everybody. This is quite an honor to get to be on stage here with Roger. Roger, as many of you know, is a legendary Silicon Valley investor. He's in the game for 35 years, saw many of the most important deals in Silicon Valley history take place. Early mentor to Mark Zuckerberg. And as some of you probably know from the title of his most recent book, he has turned into something of a critic of Facebook, an extremely articulate, smart, helpful critic. He also played a lead role in a cover story I wrote with Fred Vogelstein for Wired last year, tracing the evolution of Facebook. So we have a man who's been on the inside of Silicon Valley, who's invested in some of the biggest companies, who's now become one of its most influential critics, and this is the perfect time, not just the perfect month, but the perfect week to be on stage with Roger McNamee. In fact, the perfect day. So, hello, Roger.
Nick, it's a pleasure.
I also want to give some housekeeping. We will be taking questions from the audience through Slido. You've probably have seen how this works, but you can go on and you can type in your questions. They will pop on a screen. I will then ask Roger. All right, let's do this. By the way, this is the book. Y'all should get it. It's very good. All right, Roger. I want this to be a forward-looking conversation, mostly. People have read the book, they're familiar with this, but I want to ask one backwards-looking question because I think it's important. So about 10 years ago, you meet Zuckerberg. You give him very helpful advice, saying don't sell out to Yahoo. Lord knows what would have happened if he had. You become a mentor. During those early years, did you view Facebook as a cool company that had done something brilliant, smart founder? Or did you actually view it in the idealistic way, that this is the company that will connect the world and do something wonderful for humanity? How much of it was exciting new thing, and how much of it was
so
different?
When I first met Mark, he was 22. The company was 2 years old. It was still limited to college and high school students with an email account from their school. There was no news feed yet. And the day we met, I'd been in the investment business for 24 years. I'd been blessed to get there before the PC industry. So as Nick said, I'd seen a lot of things. And I was asked to take a meeting without knowing the topic. And yet, when Mark came to see me, I already was convinced that Facebook was the next big thing, that he had broken the code, the thing that had killed every attempt at social apps before that, whether it was AOL or The Well, whether it was Friendster, or MySpace. Essentially, the ability to be anonymous allowed trolls to take over. And I was convinced that Mark's requirement of authenticated identity was literally the holy grail. It was the thing that was going to unlock this opportunity. And the fact that he gave you real control of privacy was a big deal.
But unlock a financial opportunity or unlock a moral opportunity?
Well, from my perspective, there was no investment opportunity. So when I first met him, I was going into a meeting to give advice to a young man.
Yeah.
And so I viewed this as what we had learned was connecting people on big networks always devolved into sort of trolldom.
Yeah.
And I was convinced he had the way to fix that. So there was a distinct idealism to it. And because there was no investment opportunity, I was there because I wanted to meet the young guy who'd figured this thing out.
So he'd figured out how to make a big network work. And you, as someone who'd been in Silicon Valley, as everybody tried to crack the idea of a big network that would actually make the world a better place, you supported this as a cause in some ways.
Well, don't give me too much credit. I looked at this as, you know, technology for 50 years before that point had produced nothing but positive outcomes for society.
Yeah.
So I didn't even have it in my head that a thing like Facebook could go bad. So the idealism that was there was something that everyone in my generation would have had dating back to the 50s. And you know, when I looked at Mark, I was looking at a guy, I mean, they were 20 years old when they figured out that you could apply graph theory to a network design. I mean, that was just, I mean, that was like such a genius insight. And again, I was just meeting with a young guy. The question was, could I help him out?
Right.
I didn't have to have like a massive moral view, but whatever one I had was this pure idealism I had about tech. I was a technology optimist like everybody else.
Okay, well, let's dig into that, right? I'm the editor of a magazine, which used to have the motto, change is good. And now we run a few critical stories from time to time.
No, not you.
How do you look back at that period of optimism? Do you say it was the right attitude for the time, and the times are different? Do you say, damn, what was I thinking?
No, I look at it as I give myself a break on 2006, because in 2006, again, we were in the early days of Web 2.0, of this notion that we were going to replace the web of pages with a web of people. And I had not tipped to Google's strategy of taking what they called the digital exhaust of search queries and of email and of maps and applying it to behavioral prediction. I was not, I mean, I consider that a major failure of analysis on my part, but I did not know about that then. So maybe I was stupid, but I, you know, I don't look at this as, you know, somehow in any, you know, I look at this like there were things I might have known then that I did not know that I wish I'd known now.
But you give yourself a break, not just on 2006, but on like 1982 to 2006.
Well, I look at 82 to 2006 as a period where anything that wasn't helpful to humanity died very quickly. And so, you know, you, again, you didn't need to have a deep moral thing because everybody had a moral sense. The notion that technology could improve people's lives was so deeply baked into everybody. And what's the, you know, the change that took place in 2004 was really 2003 was that the PayPal mafia had these two genius insights. The first was the Web 2.0 one about going to to an internet of people. I mean, that was so brilliant, it's hard to, you know, overstate. And then secondly, the idea that all of the limits of technology, processing power, storage, memory, bandwidth, were disappearing, and that you could build things at a global scale, and therefore the notion of blitzscaling became, yeah, you know, a core thing. These guys had that insight in front of literally everyone. And I think all of that would have worked out perfectly if their value system had been more humanitarian and more humanistic than it was. I think that the value system they brought to it, which of course they're entitled to, you know, but it had this notion that none of us is responsible for the consequences, you know, of the disruptions that we create. And that was incredibly convenient if you're doing a startup.
Wait.
But at large volumes, it created risk.
I don't want to spend too much time in the past, but let me ask about that. So you just described it as though the founders of these companies brought a value system into Silicon Valley, not that Silicon Valley ineluctably created this value system.
No, they brought
the money
it in.
That was flowing in.
I believe
different people, different companies going into the same ecosystem, different results?
Would have had different results, yes. But I don't think you'd have had the same ecosystem. You needed the genius of the PayPal mafia.
Right.
No, I mean, these guys were simply operating at a different level. And without them, I don't think we see what we wound up getting. I mean, the Google guys were outside that, but they were already on this notion of, you know, it was okay to essentially track people everywhere and to send cars in and photograph your house with you in front of it like that was okay, and to, you know, to take pictures of your house from the top, and, you know, to gather all this data, you know, whether it was your credit card information or your health data if they could get it, or everywhere you went on the web, they all felt like they could take that and that was okay. I don't think in prior generations of Silicon Valley people would have thought that way.
Right. So it's a combination of the infinite power being created by the computers plus a value system that you don't think is the right one, which then leads to what you see and you observe very well.
At small scale, I think it was fine, right?
Yeah.
It was when it got to global scale, then the problems became obvious. And the other real, to me, the other real sign of the genius of these people was how big the businesses got before the problems really showed up.
Yeah.
I mean, the notion that you got to several billion active users before it was apparent that there was something wrong with the model, I mean, seriously, these people are brilliant, and I have enormous admiration for what they created. I just wish we could have created it without some of the business model characteristics that are causing the harm.
All right, great. Well, let's jump ahead now from 2008, 2009, to all the way up to 2019. So what happens in the intervening period? You are one of the first people to observe Russian activity on the platform. You see it in the Bernie Sanders campaign. You bring it to Zuckerberg and Sandberg. You kind of get brushed off. You have some conversations with Dan Rose. You turn more and more into a critic, and you become a critic at a time where the world becomes critical, and you become one of the leading spokesmen. And so all of this is going on. And so in the last year, Facebook makes a lot of changes, right? They put hundreds of people building AI systems to knock out toxic content. They make it much easier for you to adjust your privacy settings. They just do a really interesting thing where they change the KPIs of their employees so they're rewarded not on company growth, but on company's success at meeting its values. Do you think the stuff that Facebook has rolled out in the last year is good?
I don't think it's been effective. And I'll give you an example. Facebook created a database of political advertisements. And in principle, that's a really good idea. But what you'd really like to have is lots of independent people to verify what's going on inside that database. And one of the most visible active players there was ProPublica. And Facebook wound up banning ProPublica from the database. And the sad thing about this is that Facebook has historically behaved as though it was okay to apologize and then just go back to doing what you were doing before. And for the longest time, nobody was watching closely enough or could see well enough to see that that's what was going on. But now that people are watching closely, I think that that game plan doesn't work the way it did for the first 15 years of the company. And so I'm candidly very disappointed because, to my mind, anybody could have had the problems that occurred through 2016. You know, we all make mistakes. The scale they operate at makes the damage of their mistakes greater. But the notion, I mean, who among us was expecting the Russians to try to interfere in our elections? I mean, our intelligence agencies didn't see it until it was too late. And, you know, I don't know why we're expecting them to see it. So I give them a pass to a large extent on 2016. Where I have the problem is that once the evidence was out, the continued obfuscation, the sort of the deny, deflect, dissemble, that whole thing doesn't work for me. And I think it's going to harm them because this was a problem that when I went to them, I'm saying, look, you're in a trust business. And the thing you can't do is hide behind a law that says you're a platform, not a media company. That if in a trust business, once people lose trust, you're screwed. And you can see this now in the Nielsen numbers, right? They're down, what is it, 20%? You know, from the high, 15. In terms of usage, and whatever the number is, it's enough to be alarming, and you can see from their behavior that they're alarmed by it.
It's 15% on the core Blue app. If you combine Instagram and WhatsApp, it's still doing well. Let me ask the first question from the audience. Do you still have a Facebook account?
I do, and not only do I have it, I've written a book, which Nick has here. And if you want to promote a book for people who are on Facebook and Instagram, I got a really good piece of advice. You want to advertise on Facebook and Instagram. So the thing that people, right? Duh. So the thing, get this. I still own my position in Facebook because I didn't want anybody to think that I was trashing a stock that I had sold. And so I held my position on the theory that if the stock went down, look, I've profited from it. And so if the stock went down, I felt it was appropriate for me to take a hit. And, you know, that's just my personal value system. I don't ask any of you to behave that way. And the thing that I've discovered is I'm not the perfect messenger for this message, right? Obviously, for Zuck and Sheryl and Dan Rose, I was the wrong guy. And to this day, I remain the wrong guy for Facebook. What I ask people to do is just think about the message and understand that this isn't really about Facebook. It started for me there because that was the company I knew best, and it's where I saw the symptoms first in January of 2016. But this is a problem that is endemic in a world where the business model is about, you know, tracking human beings, claiming eminent domain on their personal data, using it for behavioral prediction, and then using the tools of machine learning, artificial intelligence, and AI to steer people towards outcomes that make those predictions more valuable. And I'm saying, you know, to me, maybe the world's gonna like that idea, but they haven't had a chance to actually deliberate it. We really haven't had a chance to have the conversation about, is it legitimate for companies to claim ownership and trade in our private financial transactions data? Or the health and wellness data that we put into apps that we're using to try to improve our lives, or our location as tracked by cell companies, or what we do on the web is tracked by anybody. That may be fine, but all of that business model developed without, you know, it developed behind a curtain. We didn't know that's what was going on. And I think there's a lot of history that says that
that's a model we don't want. We don't want behavioral modification by corporations to be a big part of our lives.
Let's go back to the very beginning of your answer. Do you use custom audiences on Facebook when you're promoting your book? Like, when you buy Facebook ads to get people to buy Zucked, how are you targeting? Like, what information is most effective for you?
It's really simple. So the answer to your question is yes. We put up a whole bunch of things of me talking about what I thought the issues were. Uh-huh. And if people responded to the issues, we targeted them.
Uh-huh. So you are using Facebook ads to target book sales to Facebook critics.
To Facebook users who I hope will become Facebook users. No, to be clear, this is called guerrilla warfare. Hang on just a sec. I am one person. I am up against a company with tens of billions of dollars of annual profit. I tried for 3 months to persuade them privately that there was a real problem here, back when the cost of solving it would have been next to nothing, right? And my point to you here is this isn't about, this is about a business model. And if my using their tools exposes the flaw in all of this, then God bless, right? My point is, this is not personal between me and any of these people. I have such respect for Mark and Sheryl and all the other people at Facebook. What they've accomplished is amazing. And on their own terms, it's one of the greatest business models ever executed. And yet, the terms under which they executed are hostile to each and every one of us, even if we're profiting from some other part of the business. And I look at this and I go, again, people may choose to disagree with me, and that's fine. But I do think we have to have the conversation.
And I'm not calling you a hypocrite for buying Facebook ads, because I buy them too. How do you think we target Wired subscribers? Well, in fact, I got briefly banned because I bought an ad for Nicholas Thompson's Facebook page, and I put a Wired story that had a picture of Robert Mueller that they classified as political. Anyway.
Well, and to be clear, we've had moments where they, shall we say, took exception. I tried to promote the Time magazine cover story, and it took a few days for them to get past the notion of me promoting a cover story about the book. And all it said was, thank you, Time magazine. Mm-hmm. And it got shut down a few times. The account got shut down after I'd spent a pile of money building the custom audience. And then somebody thought about it and realized, you know what, we really need to let this go forward. And I have enormous respect for the people who made that decision.
All right, listen.
I think these are really good people. I just think nobody's ever told them where the edges ought to be.
Well, let's talk about where they think the edges are now. Because I think one of the most interesting things that Facebook has done in the last 2 years, certainly in its time of troubles, is Mark Zuckerberg's statement that he put out earlier this week.
Yeah.
He said, look, we're going to focus on privacy. We've seen that the future is end-to-end encrypted messaging. We're not sure what our business model will be around that, but we are going to move into a new world and to design a new platform that takes privacy much more seriously. Also, we're not going to put servers in authoritarian countries. What did you think about his statement?
So I started with, we're not going to put servers in authoritarian countries piece. And if they follow through on that, I'm going to be first in line to praise them. That is such a cool thing to do, okay? Because it means they're giving up China. It means they're going to exit Vietnam, a country that they have massive market share in. They'll exit a bunch of other countries, probably the Philippines, too, where they do all their moderation.
The way the world is going, probably a lot of the world.
And so I look at this, and if he follows through on that, I'm going to sit there and go, man, that is such a righteous thing to do. God bless.
You rename the second edition of this?
Yeah, I'll go Zucked rules. So when I get to the part about privacy, I'm a big believer in end-to-end encryption. But I think we all need to understand that encrypting your messages and encrypting your posts addresses about 1% of the problem I'm describing.
Yeah.
And it has a convenient byproduct, which makes me think two things. First, there must be something bad coming. Maybe it's the FTC with a fine relative to the consent decree. Maybe it's something else. But they're doing something that they would do anyway. I think they look at WeChat and go, that's a better model for a bunch of different reasons. Maybe we try to go to that. But what I'm suggesting here is that the second element is the one to look at, which is that, hey, if you end-to-end encrypt, your moderation problem goes away completely. So from Facebook's point of view, what they're trying to do is to get credit for something like it's noble that doesn't actually address the problem,
that does solve their biggest business problem, which is that they've done a lousy job protecting the people who use their products. And
but they're not getting rid of Newsfeed. I mean, there will still be.
So that's what we're getting to the end point here, which is at the end of the day, the thing that really worries me, and this so-called manifesto doesn't touch it, is that the value and the problems really are associated with metadata and data collected outside of Facebook, neither of which are covered by this manifesto. And so when I look at this, it's, you know, Zuck made very clear, I think, in an interview a week or two ago, that they're not getting out of the tracking business. Mm-hmm. And my problem with Facebook is not whether it's end-to-end encrypted or not. It's not what they do with my personal information. It's what are they doing with the tracking? What are they doing to invade my private spaces? You know, what are they looking at? I'm glad they're not going to look at texts anymore. That's a good thing. But I don't want them buying my credit card history. I do not want them doing business with health and wellness apps to get all of that data. I do not want them buying my location data for my cellular carrier. I do not want them tracking me all around the web. I mean, I'm not into that. And I'm sitting there going, look, we're better than this. They would have a great business without doing any of that stuff. And I'd like to help them get there.
So your view of Zuckerberg's privacy manifesto is that it's a little bit of a head fake, and that it's dealing with privacy in a narrow sense, and your concerns are much privacy in a much bigger sense?
Well, I would say that would be one way to put it. The other thing I would say is that it's a very effective public relations move that is, once again, deflecting us away from the core problem.
And the core problem is
the core problem, is not a Facebook problem. It is an industry problem. I mean, Google invented it in 2002. They patented it in 2003. And then, you know, now you've also got Amazon in this business, Microsoft is in this business. And so there's a lot of people, you know, there's at least four people who are playing this business at scale.
Oh, there's definitely more than four. That's a wonderful segue. So let's go into the other news of the week. The reason I said it was such a perfect week to have Roger, because we have a big statement from Mark Zuckerberg, and a big statement from Elizabeth Warren, saying it's time to break up the big tech companies. So let's take another question from the audience. Can you comment on Senator Warren's suggestion that she'll work to dismantle organizations like Google and Facebook and Amazon?
Yeah.
How reasonable is this, and how valid?
So I think Warren's proposal is brilliant. And
is Elizabeth Warren in the audience in the back there?
We can only hope. So,
okay, describe the specifics of the proposal to the audience, in case not everyone's read Medium.
So here's the key point, is that Warren makes a couple observations. One is that there is a behavior that's now rampant in the tech industry of people who operate a marketplace and then also are a participant in it. The most obvious one of that is Amazon's marketplace with Amazon Basics. But the same thing applies to Google with respect to their various advertising. You know, DoubleClick is an ad market, and then they operate inside that marketplace. And they do so to the detriment of competitors. And this is an issue that really plagues those guys. And Facebook, with its advertising products, does the same thing. And Facebook has also done a version of that relative to news, right? And so her basic point is that there is a fundamental element of fairness in the American economy that basically says you get to do either a marketplace or be a participant, but not both. And I think there are other aspects of this thing we can go into. What I would like to point out is that the history of antitrust in tech is that it is amazingly pro-growth. It began in 1956. AT&T had a consent decree with the Justice Department, which it agreed to limit itself to the telecom market. It had two effects. The first was it created the computer industry as we knew it. IBM got to have a separate industry. And on top of that, they licensed all of their patents, including the transistor. So it literally created Silicon Valley. Meanwhile, AT&T went to new highs. In the mid-60s, there was an antitrust case against IBM that created the personal computer industry. IBM went to new highs. There was a second AT&T case in the mid-80s that brought cellular forward 10 years, and it brought broadband data communications forward at least that much. And the components of AT&T went to new highs. Then there was the Microsoft case, which created the internet, and as we've seen lately, Microsoft goes to new highs. So the history of this thing is, if you want to create a new tech industry, the best thing to do is to put a fence around the monopolists who've dominated the old category. And the basic approach that Warren is bringing is actually borrowed from a Republican, Teddy Roosevelt. She's applying the same basic test that Roosevelt applied to Standard Oil and the other monopolies of the Gilded Age, of the robber baron age. And it is, what's beautiful about it is that it's very well thought out. And the notion is exactly the same kinds of stuff she's been proposing for years around banks. And she is an absolute expert on that. And the one thing I would observe is I found it very gratifying that Amy Klobuchar, who right. of the people currently running for president, is the other person who's really focused in this category, followed almost immediately indicating a similar point of view.
Slightly softer, but a similar point of view.
But similar point of view. My point is everybody's entitled to pick.
So are you, two big parts of Elizabeth Warren's, I mean, there are many, many parts to it, but the two parts that stuck out the most are, one, the marketplace idea, which I agree with. The second is to unwind mergers that have been approved. So in Facebook's case, that would be WhatsApp and Instagram. In Google's place, that would be YouTube. Do you actually agree with that?
Waze. It would also be
and Waze. Yeah. Do you agree with that? Would you unwind Instagram and WhatsApp from Facebook? Would you unwind YouTube from Google?
I would like to try. Yeah. I think if Google, I went to Google a year ago and proposed to them that they spin off YouTube because I thought that YouTube's incentive structure was preventing them from addressing all the toxic activity that goes on inside YouTube, and that YouTube would be better off as an independent business for that reason. As with Facebook a year earlier, they were not too interested in my point of view, but shock.
Are you advising Elizabeth Warren?
Advising is too strong a word. I've met with Senator Warren. I've met with her staff. I've met with...
What other Democratic candidates have you met with to give advice to on antitrust?
Well, so I've met with Klobuchar's staff. I've met with Cory Booker. I've met with a number of people. I'm very, very supportive of the approach that Warren has here. And I have talked to their policy people. And they reached out to me before they did this, and I was happy to help, and I would help any candidate who was looking to focus in this area.
All right, well, all the Democratic candidates are here at South By. Anything wants to talk about antitrust, Roger's
well,
available
I would say
backstage.
It goes beyond antitrust, though. I mean,
well, that's what I want to ask next.
I want to talk about the agenda. All the other things related to these platforms.
But before we leave antitrust, there's another element of Warren's proposal that I think you have particular insight into.
So the answer to your question is yes, I have advised Warren's team about this stuff.
There's an element of what Warren wrote in that Medium post. One thing she said is that venture capital is less likely to fund startups because they know that the big companies can crush the startups.
That's been my experience.
You could also look at it the other way, that venture capital is very happy to fund startups because you know that the big monopoly companies will overpay for acqui-hires or for technology they think they can bring in.
But acqui-hires are always a failure from the venture guy's point of view. What's really been going on, and Google, again, this is how smart these guys are. Google Ventures goes out there and says, gosh, we're gonna invest in blockchain, and we're gonna invest in scooters, and we're gonna invest in stuff your parents used to do for you. And they track billions of dollars into those categories, right. Which are more capital intensive. They may be great categories, but they're more capital intensive than core web. And so they take billions of dollars out of their competitive space and put it elsewhere. Meanwhile, they go in and crush lots of anything that sticks its head up. You know what, if you simply look what Instagram/Facebook are doing to Snap right now, I mean, that goes on every single day. And the venture guys and the entrepreneurs are looking at this going, I'm going to steer clear of this.
Venture guy, after Facebook puts money into, after Facebook acquires Oculus, you would look at all VR companies differently and you would say,
I can tell you that's exactly what happened. I mean, Oculus, that intellectual property was coming out of USC. It was available more or less to anybody. And it just stopped once they put their money in. And, you know, I can't tell you exactly what the rate of development should have been, but I can tell you at the time they bought it, they thought they were going to have a consumer product out before now.
And so one other reason to support antitrust would
be... And the incentives are less inside Facebook than they would be if you were, you know, living paycheck to paycheck the way a normal venture company would. And so my simple point here is not that any of these other categories are not interesting categories, but rather that they have successfully diverted an enormous amount of capital away from competition in their core space at a very time when we should be having distributed alternatives to every single thing they do. I mean, my core point here is, and I'm really optimistic, because this is a problem, the technology solution for which should create the biggest economic opportunity of our lifetime. I mean, The industry is like pegged to the centralized model, which is nuts, because historically it goes back and forth from centralized to distributed, and Apple should not be the only guy doing distributed. I mean, it's nuts.
So I want to ask one more thing about antitrust. So my concern, I've always bought the argument that certainly we want more competition, certainly there would be more competition if there weren't monopolies. Do I want the Donald Trump Justice Department trying to figure out a solution and a sensible solution to break up these large tech companies in a way that will make the American economy more efficient? No, I do not. Do I want a different Department of Justice to break them up? Possibly, but if you're dependent upon the goodwill of the Department of Justice to carry out antitrust effectively, then are you making a mistake to trust any Department of Justice with it?
So I have a different point of view than you, okay? So I've been spending time with the Trump Justice Department and the Trump Federal Trade Commission, and I'm happy to take my chances with them. I think they are not only well-meaning people, I think they're taking this very seriously. Here's the thing. If you believe in sort of Republican economic values, antitrust is a Republican concept.
Absolutely.
It is very pro-growth. It is very pro-entrepreneurship. And if you're in the Trump administration, you know that these guys have overplayed their hand. They've gone too far. Something has to be done. And if you're going to do something, better antitrust than some heavyweight regulatory framework that kills everybody. I mean, the problem with global data protection regulation is twofold. It aims at the wrong problem, which is the data you put in the system, and it's incredibly cumbersome and heavyweight on everybody. And what I would rather do is to see approaches that allow entrepreneurship to happen, allow small things, allow competition, different business models, different product architectures, right? This notion that everything has to be cloud-based just because you can start on Amazon Web Services, I mean, that's nuts. The first thing I want to do is create an alternative to Amazon Web Services that has, you know, has virtual clouds and is highly distributed. Most of the stuff happens on your phone, and they give you a similar kinds of things.
What do you mean, the first thing you want to do? You want to start that company? You want to invest in that company?
If I were in the investment business anymore, that's what I would want to do, right? And I want to do things for private login that protect your data. I think there's a lot more of us than there are of them. So I think if you make products for real human beings,
I mean,
that's a giant business.
Sold out a giant convention hall here at South by Southwest with your
book. Hang on, guys. I'm really serious about this. You can change the world. We all can. We not only have the votes to constrain this business model, we have more than enough intellect, and there's more than enough capital out there to create new models that are worth way, way more to us than whatever it is we can do at the margin of Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft.
All right, let's move to the, I was checking because I paused there because if there was applause, then I figured he was right. And if there wasn't, I figure I'll just hate watching. All right, another question from the audience, which I think flows very nicely from what you just said. Platforms are much more regulated and under jurisdiction in the European Union. What do you make of the European approach to platforms in digital tech?
Yeah, so here's the thing. Europe has an advantage, right? None of these guys are based there. Right? In fact, hardly any of the entrepreneurship is based there, so there's less self-impact.
Chicken egg, right? I mean, you
no,
would
no,
argue.
No, but I'm saying there's less self-impact from putting heavy regulation.
That is true.
Regulation
but you could also argue that the heavy regulation is why those guys aren't there. But let's not get into that. You keep going on your role.
Well, all I'm saying here is, right, imagine you're me, right? And you're sitting there trying to have a conversation about what kind of world do we want to live in. The Europeans have been in the game for a few years, and they've called attention to a whole bunch of the problems. For that, I'm eternally grateful. If I get a chance to do this, I want to do it a different way. So for example, the state of California has passed a privacy law modeled on global data protection regulation. Again, it's way too narrow. It's less heavyweight than GDPR. But there is a bill coming before the California legislature that I think is wildly more important. And that pierces.
Yeah.
That pierces the terms of service to give every person who uses these products a right to sue to recover damages. This is really important because it changes incentives. If you want companies to self-regulate, there's got to be an incentive on the other side. There's got to be a penalty. The problem with all this stuff is there have been no penalties.
This is why you've kept your Facebook account, so you can join the class action suit.
I had not thought about that, but that's why he gets paid the big bucks, right? That's why he's in charge of this panel, and I'm just the victim.
All right, let's go through the let's get the rest of your regulatory agenda. So give us the Roger McNamee 5-point regulatory agenda for the tech industry.
So the critical thing is I want to clear space for startups, for innovation, for alternative business models using antitrust. The most important thing I want to do is I want to have a national debate as part of the 2020 election cycle on whether or not it should be legal for companies, any corporation or anybody, to do commerce, either by selling, trading, or even acquiring our private data without our explicit permission for that transaction. So why is it legal for credit card processors and banks to sell our personal financial transaction records? Why is it legal for cellular companies to sell our location? Why is it legal for companies that make apps for health and wellness to sell or trade our health and wellness data? Why is it legal for anybody on the web to transact in our web history? Why is it legal for anybody to even collect data on kids under 18, much less sell? I want to have that conversation and that debate. I want to find out where the lines are. My preferred way of doing it is to say no to all of those things and then have the conversation, right? And just say, look, okay, what are the terms where it's okay? I mean, it's obviously okay for you to give your location to Uber, but I don't think it should be okay for Uber to then own your location history and trade it to somebody else, right? It's obviously okay for your credit card processor to have your credit card history. It's just not cool for them to sell it to anybody who wants it, okay? And I look at this, but that's the debate I want to have. And if you disagree with me, you know what, God bless, but let's have the conversation. And I think it should be part of 2020, because here's what's cool about it. That's not a right versus left issue. It's a right versus wrong issue. How much? Yeah. I don't want to live in a totalitarian country. And I think that should apply to corporations as well as the government. Right? My life is way more regulated by the code and the algorithms of these companies than it is by the law. And I'm sort of sitting there going, you know what? There's got to be a limit, right? I mean, I look at Google Street View, and I look at Google, you know, with the satellite views, and I look at Pokemon Go, and go, the thing isn't your data, right? You know what I'm saying? The issue here isn't that your data's out there. The issue is that they're getting data that's public that should be protected for everybody. It's like they put a fence around the park, and now they're charging admission. And I'm going, hang on, I don't want behavioral modification in my life. Right? I play this game against Google, right? Getting off Google is really hard, right? You've probably seen, you know, Cashmere Hill and some of the other people who tried to do it. So I tried to do it. I realized I had to make it a video game. I turned it into Frogger. I'm the frog, Google's the river. I was doing really well. So I was doing really well until just the other day. I was going to meet somebody in Cambridge, Massachusetts last week. They sent me their location, and it was like they'd used a URL shortener, and I wasn't paying attention. I open up, it's Google Maps. I'm in the river.
All right, so the Frogger game is you're trying not to click on YouTube?
My high score is 2 months. If you can top it, call me. Okay?
You've gone 2 months without watching YouTube?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's really hard. If you're a musician, going 2 months without YouTube is brutally difficult, okay?
That's tough stuff.
And that's the point. These guys are everywhere, right? And look, everybody does it their own way. The thing that's beautiful about this, right, is we just need to talk about it. We need to decide what's okay, right? And we need to do it together.
So nobody send Roger a bit.ly link with a YouTube embed of this talk. You said you don't want to live in a totalitarian country, which I think is a good segue into another thing I want to talk to you about, which is China, right? So I think that one of the greatest threats to technology in the world, and in some ways to open societies, and your friend George Soros has made this point, is that the world divides into a US tech sphere and a Chinese tech sphere. And in fact, the Chinese tech sphere, which gets massive subsidies by the government and has no restrictions, or has few restrictions on privacy, develops much more quickly. China's artificial intelligence develops more quickly as well, because artificial intelligence, particularly the subset of machine learning, thrives on data. So you could look at the world as it is right now, cleaving into a US tech sector and a Chinese tech sector, and say, Is it the right policy for the US government to keep kicking the big tech companies in the shins while the Chinese government is helping them as much as possible? Is that what we want to do? So let's start with that, and let's get into this bigger question more broadly, because I think it's one of the most interesting debates that we're not, the world's not having enough of right now.
So a couple thoughts about this. First of all, I would like to believe that AI is not just one thing.
Definitely, definitely.
Okay? I believe AI is many things, and that AI can be the technology penicillin of the 21st century if we direct it at things that actually improve.
Either the penicillin or the Ebola. I'm with you.
Okay, well, I'd like to go for penicillin.
I agree, more
so
likely.
The Chinese have a culture in which social credit is an acceptable extension of a whole bunch of things going on in their society. I actually believe social credit will undermine a lot of the health of their economy in the long run, because it will change incentives in subtle but profound ways over time. So if you sit there and look at the reason, you know, Google goes into the Defense Department and says, our AI is the most strategic technology of the 21st century. Do not regulate us, right? Protect us from any kind of breakup or regulation. Meanwhile, they go to the Chinese and say, here, how would you like Dragonfly, right? And it's got the same AI underneath it. My simple observation is, I don't believe that the United States has a prayer of winning the AI race in behavioral modification. We don't have the size of population. We don't have the control of the data that the Chinese have. And I would point out, culturally speaking, behavioral modification is about as un-American as anything I can imagine. And so I'm sitting there going, I would like our AI to have two fundamentally American characteristics. I want it to be about freedom, not about behavioral modification. And I want it to be about entrepreneurship. I think the way we do best in AI is to let 1,000 flowers bloom in 1,000 different spaces. And I would like one of the regulatory things that we do is to say that these technologies are at least as important, I would argue more important than energy exploration, which we currently give incentives to, and certain classes of farming, which we give incentives to. I think the government should be providing incentives for people to do technology that is good for people. Better business models of social, better business models of AI, things that actually make a difference. And again, I want to make this one of the core issues of 2020, because I think it's something that applies to everybody.
So I couldn't agree more with that. So the government incentives to increase entrepreneurship in AI would be, A, by creating a more competitive marketplace, you help many other companies.
Well,
bloom.
You protect them. You make sure that they can't be snuffed out the way, again, I'm under conscious, there's some names I can't say out loud, but I've had the personal experience of companies being snuffed out, and you have to find a way to prevent that from happening.
So prevent companies from getting snuffed out. Do you open up government databases for AI researchers? Do you publicly fund universities? What else is your agenda for improving American AI focused on freedom?
Well, I would go far enough to say, you know, you can use the tax code, you can provide capital. I mean, there are all kinds of things that we can do today. This stuff's really important. I mean, we've subsidized space exploration, we've subsidized aircraft innovation. I don't see any reason why we can't do that around here. Why wouldn't you give a tax break? I mean, for example, you might sit there and get rid of the carried interest deduction for venture capital funds, except for the things that are done in this category.
I like, well, part of what I like listening to you is that it's this combination of libertarianism, right? We really need to push on freedom, and you, Silicon Valley has long libertarian roots, and then also strong government action.
These things are not incompatible.
Well, of
if
course.
Study history. Give me just a sec.
Do it.
Study history. In capitalism, the role of government is to set the rules and then enforce them fairly across the whole economy. And, you know, when we started the current era in 1981, right, we got rid of a lot of regulation and a lot of things that had become part of the problem. But eventually, you hit the point where the deregulation just entrenched the largest incumbents and led to monopoly, not just in tech, but across the entire economy. And it's just gone too far. And my basic point is, I want to get back to capitalism.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's ask another question from the audience, because it ties in well here. So the question is, isn't the problem a lack of ethical moral core rather than a lack of external regulation? Which I think ties into the question of AI. Both as we build out AI, how do we make sure it has values that we all agree with? And how do we support that?
So I think there hasn't been any societal pressure to have an ethical moral core. We've operated for the last 38 years with the notion that the only constituency that should matter to a corporation
are its shareholders. Mm-hmm. We used to believe before 1981 that a shareholder owed a duty to a set of stakeholders that included customers, suppliers, employees, the communities where employees lived, right? That was the model that existed in the United States from the Second World War to 1981. And my simple point is that that model encouraged much better behavior and much longer-term thinking. And so in the current situation, again, I don't blame the people. I think the culture we live in has encouraged this kind of behavior. And I think the question is, are we going to reset our expectations? Are we going to reset, you know, the values that we bring to these things? Is it always about the almighty buck, or is making the world a better place actually a value we would like to pursue? And, you know, I don't want to pretend that the Silicon Valley of the 80s and 90s was somehow this philanthropic thing. It was not. It was a money-making enterprise. But there was at least more sense than you have today of the needs of other constituencies. And I would like to get back to that.
Is there more sense in 2019 than there was in 18 or than 2017? Is the trend line, in your view, going in the right direction or the wrong direction?
Right direction. So here a couple things. I mean, let me look backwards. The 2018 election was really interesting to me because there were three groups that were successfully suppressed using micro-targeting on Facebook and Instagram. They were suburban white women, people of color, and idealistic young people. The amount of disinformation in the 2018 midterms was wildly higher than 2016, and yet three groups in particular stood out for turning out their turnout, increasing their turnout: suburban white women, people of color, and idealistic young people. And to me, I think the country is making a really important turn. There have been at least five labor actions by teachers' unions in the last year that have been successful with no blowback. You had the air traffic controllers, which, with a sick out that lasted a few hours, ended a government shutdown. I mean, there's, you know, you're seeing, is it VIA, which is going out, you know, getting a lot of positive press for treating its drivers better than Uber and Lyft. You know, I just think that people are looking around and going, hang on, there are people living under bridges all over America because we aren't taking care of all the people who live here. There are people in cages at the border, children separated from their parents. I don't think that's the America we all want to live in. And my point is, all these things are coming from, you know, not bad intent so much as a loss of perspective on all the different things that, you know, that might matter in life. And you and I have a common thing. We've both had near-death experiences. And one of the things that happens after you've had that is you look at things and maybe you value them differently. And my point is, I don't want to impose my value system on anybody, but I want to give you a chance to think about what really matters to you, right? Is money the only thing that matters to you? Because look at how miserable some of these really rich people are. Look how many of these entrepreneurs are dying at 35 or 40 from drug overdoses. There's something wrong.
So, let's go to that, because you're not only an eloquent critic and an advisor to policy folks, you also run the Center for Humane Technology, and you're trying to build out a new kind of technology. Tell me where that organization is right now, and tell me what you're trying to make.
So I am an advisor to the Center for Humane Technology. Tristan Harris runs it, and you know, the notion here is a very simple one, is we want to be a clearinghouse so that people who want to use technology to build a better world, you know, can meet, greet, share ideas, and get leverage. And the thing that I would say is that, you know, my real role is to take those messages to Washington, take those messages to state houses.
Take them to Austin.
Yeah, exactly. Bring it to Austin. And, you know, the key thing here is, you guys, my book is really about a journey. In the book, I am Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window, right? I see a crime scene. I have no, pardon my French, fucking idea what I've just seen, right? And I pull on the thread, and I look back and I go, Roger, you ignorant slut, how could you possibly have missed what was going on? But for whatever reason, I did, okay? And in the book, I take you on my intellectual journey. And the core point is not because it's the whole story, because it's only chapter one of this bigger story. Right. What I've learned since is amazing. The people I've met since are unbelievable.
I'm not the answer to this. This isn't about me. It's just I have a biography that gives me a chance to talk about this stuff and expose everybody to all the brilliant people who are doing the real work. People like Tristan, people like Rene D'Arresta, right? People like Sandy Perikilis, people like, you know, Elizabeth Warren, right? I mean, I look at this and I go, the conversation has started, Nick.
But what is humane technology? I mean, there are a lot of entrepreneurs, they're developers, they're engineers, they're activists, they're people building things. What in your mind is humane technology?
I just think it's going back to Steve Jobs' vision of bicycles for the mind. It's this notion that technology should empower us. My problem with Google, let Google do it, is that AI is being applied right now to three broad categories: eliminating work, white collar work, filter bubbles, and recommendation engines. In short, your job, what you believe, and the things you like. And I'm sitting there going, I'm sorry, but the thing that makes Nick different from me, whatever the list of top 10 things are, our work, the things we believe, and the things that we enjoy and purchase are right near the top. I don't want to delegate that to somebody's AI. And I'm really bothered by the fact that we're making all these AIs and inheriting the implicit bias of the real world, that you get recruiting apps that review resumes that are biased against women and people of color, that you get redlining built into mortgage applications, that you can't recognize people of color in a facial recognition. And the part that bothers me more than anything is that as humans, we trust technology to be neutral. So it's entirely possible that the people buying this stuff are buying it explicitly to protect themselves against the accusation of bias. That if you're a tech company, you like having white and Asian males between 25 and 35. Having an AI sorting through your resumes is very convenient.
So what is okay? I want to go to an audience. Who are the people investing in an alternative future? Like, what is a specific example of something that you would call humane technology?
I'm waiting to see it, right? Because I'm not investing now. Now I'm mostly right in this mode. So I'm sure there's a lot of stuff out there. I'm not seeing much of it because I don't have the bandwidth to do it right now. What I would observe, though, let's look at one really obvious example we all know, which is Apple.
Yep.
Right? So Apple is not perfect, right? There's a bunch of stuff they do badly. Their supply chain in China scares the crap out of
me. A lot of stuff in China.
Right? There's a lot of things I don't like about what they do. But what they are doing around protecting personal privacy is really important. You know, what they did after San Bernardino, calling the FBI's bluff, going, come on, guys, you can open this phone. We're just not putting a back door into it, right? But that was really risky, right? Politically. You know, shutting down Google and Facebook for a day over the research apps, right? That is not a riskless transaction for them. And my simple point is, Apple's a big company. I was not expecting them to take any risk on stuff at all, and I'm happy they're doing so. And I look at this today, and if you have an Android, you really got to ask yourself, I mean, why? I get that the camera is better, okay? But take the SIM card out, right? If you want the camera, God bless. But seriously, why would you open yourself up and walk? I mean, you're basically taking your data and handing it out to everybody you meet. I mean, it's nuts.
You're going to end up, that little clip is going to appear in an Apple keynote speech sometime in the next 3 months. Please, I hope the cameras are turned off then. All right, let's ask this is a very big, important question from the audience. All things considered, do you think Facebook has been a net positive or net negative? 5 minutes left. Let's do it, Roger.
I'm going to do it in two words, net negative.
Okay, let's change it. Do you think that over the next 10 years, Facebook will be a net positive or a net negative?
I think they can control that. I don't know. I would like to think they could be a net positive. They have to change their business model. But everybody,
pause
seriously.
Pause there. Do they have to change that? So
I don't think they can keep their current business model and be a net positive.
You don't think you can just change the math of newsfeed, the way privacy settings work, and all the other things with the same business model, have it be a less successful business model but different core structure?
Sorry, I call that
changing the business model. Okay.
So here's the thing. I am much more worried today about Google, Amazon, Microsoft, than I am about Facebook, because Facebook has been clumsy enough to have been caught, and they're on the defensive. And the other guys have been much more clever. And my point is, Facebook portal got shot down like on day one. Whereas Amazon and the various Google products that are in the smart device complex, I mean, they're taking surveillance into places it doesn't belong.
All right, wait. So we've hammered Facebook, we've hammered Google. Let's hammer Amazon and Microsoft for a little bit. What are the worst defenses of Microsoft?
Well, Microsoft, you know, they have a relatively lame product in Bing, right? But they have an absolutely market-dominant product in LinkedIn that is, I'm sure everybody in this room but me is on LinkedIn. And they are simply siphoning off all of your behavioral prediction, what they would call digital exhaust, which is really digital solid gold. And they then have this giant AI operation, right, so that they can, if you will, influence the outcome relative to the behavioral predictions to make them more valuable. And you can see it in their numbers. Their numbers have just gone completely bananas. And this is why.
What social harm
is it? It's not because of the word.
Wait. This conversation is going in the direction I did not expect. Tell me the social harm done by LinkedIn.
It's not LinkedIn per se. It's what they're doing with the... So it's this notion of surveillance and creating a market of behavioral prediction based on our most private things, okay?
Right.
So it's this notion that when you're on these platforms, nothing you do is private. Everything you do is being turned into a monetizable unit and sold to the highest bidder. And I'm sitting there going, look, maybe all you guys have better control of everything you do online than I do, but I'm sitting there going, look, I wanna have a conversation about where the limits are. And again, it may be that there's no harm being done, but there's nothing to prevent harm from being done. And that's the part that scares me, right? There's no limits right now to what you can do with that data. Let me give you the example. Everybody here use CAPTCHA, right? You're in there, they want to find out if you're a robot, right? Right? And you have to look at those pictures, right? Identify the cars or the stop signs, right? Obviously, Google doesn't need that to figure out you're a human, right? They do that so that you're training the AI for their self-driving cars. They figure out you're a human based on your mouse movement. All of these guys are tracking your mouse movement. Now let's roll it forward. All of a sudden, the first day that you have a symptom of a neurological disease, let's say Parkinson's, or something more severe. Now, in the current regime, they have no obligation to inform you. They have no obligation to protect the privacy of that medical diagnosis. All of the incentives are to sell it to the highest bidder. And I would argue that the highest bidder in the United States of America is likely to be your insurance company. So they can either get rid of your insurance or raise your rates, and they can do all that before you even know you're sick.
So is the solution to stop the mouse tracking so that they don't have the data, or is it to regulate the way they use the data so they tell you you have incipient
Parkinson's? I think they should have to tell you, and I think they should have to keep it private. I think it should be HIPAA governed.
So then it's collecting the data.
No, I actually believe that this is a great application.
Yeah, that's what
I'm sitting there and saying I would be willing to pay some serious money to have that diagnosis. It's a medical diagnosis, and if it's accurate, it's worth money. But my point here is, right now, again, this is why we have to have a conversation. This isn't like maybe sometime in 10 years. They could probably do this now. And I just look at it and go, I would like to have some thought that I'm not competing against these behemoths every time I move my mouse.
All right, last question from the audience, since we're almost out of time. Do you think Mark should step down as CEO?
No, I don't think so. I don't think this is about the people. And I believe that this is about the business model, and Larry and Sergey at Google, Mark and Sheryl at Facebook have the moral authority to change the business model. If you don't change the business model, it doesn't matter who's running it. And if you do change the business model, it's okay whoever's running it. And so I don't believe that's the right answer. I think that's kind of a knee-jerk response, and I wouldn't go that way. I have too much respect for Mark, too much respect for Sheryl, too much respect for Larry and Sergey. I believe they are one good night's sleep away from the epiphany. Okay? Hang on. This is actually serious. We're running out of time, but this is serious. They can do 100 times as much good by reforming their companies as they could possibly do with a foundation. And I want them to look at it that way.
All right. That is the perfect note to end on. I hope that however they reform their business model, they still allow Roger to sell books through the ad product. Thank you for all the amazing questions. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being a great audience. And thank you so much, Roger.
Thank you very much.